right. The air conditioning is turned off just in time to hear me speak. And so we are going to begin our Sunday school lesson. Today is Sunday, December the 2nd, 2012, and it's 10 a.m. I always like to start on time, and I guess we are starting on time. So thank you all for coming. I am very, very excited to be talking about some of the most important subjects of which I am aware. The way I think about Pericles, Plutarch, the ancient Greeks, and many other subjects, is I like to think about that this is the language of free people. If we are to be free people, we must know the history of free people, and our history of freedom comes mostly, I think, from the Greeks. So today, as you may recall, we discussed last month that we were going to start doing a couple of Plutarch's lives, and the first life, which is of most interest to me, is Pericles. Next month, we want to do the parallel life, because Pluto wrote parallel lives. He was trying to give moral instruction, and he looked at two lives, a Greek life and a Roman life, in parallel. And next month, we will look at the life of Fabius Maximus, who is a Roman who was successful in resisting Hannibal's invasions. His dates were 275 to 203 BC. So for next time, we'll do Fabius Maximus, who's a Roman life of Plutarch. My guess is that not many people read the essay, Plutarch's essay on Pericles, and perhaps one of the reasons for that is it's not, you know, you have to go to the internet and find it and read it, or you have to buy the book and read it from there. So for next month, what I probably will do is actually copy the essay and then mail it out as a part of a newsletter so that those people who are coming to Sunday school can have access to the real essay. This essay that we're going to talk about today is about 30 pages long. It's a fairly easy read, but it's a rather long essay, and obviously it would be useful to do it. Now let me tell you what the plan for today is. The first thing I want to do is to put Pericles in a historical context. The next thing I want to do is read some of the episodes, very short, single paragraphs, from this 30-page, plus or minus, life of Pericles, so that we can get some idea of the morality of the man, of the character of the man. And when I have done that, we are going to have a dramatic reading by Ron, who is going to read Pericles' funeral oration, which, in my opinion, is one of the greatest speeches ever given. And he is going to do that as a dramatic reading. The first half of our morning activities, I'm going to aim at 20 minutes. And then the speech takes about 20 minutes. And then we will adjourn briefly until we start the big show at 11 a.m. So first, let me put the life of Pericles in some context. What I think is important to understand about Pericles is that his life and his powers occur between two great wars in ancient Greece. The first great war is the war with Persia, and the second, that's the beginning of his life, and at the end of his life, the other life that brackets his life, the other war that brackets Pericles' life are the Peloponnesian Wars. Now, some of the Persian Wars, the details of the Persian Wars are really very familiar. It's part of the vocabulary of our liberty. And it's the subject of modern movies. I mean, many of us saw the movie 300, which was the story of Thermopylae. Thermopylae actually is the beginning of the second Persian invasion. The first Persian invasions began about 492, which was 2 years before the birth, 2 or 3 years before the birth of Pericles. So Pericles is simultaneous with these events. That war ended with the Battle of Marathon in 490 BC, and we'll remember that because we remember the story about Pheidippides, who supposedly ran from Marathon to Athens to announce the great victory of the Athenians over the Persians and fell dead on the spot. And the Pheidippides is, we have a store in Atlanta now called Pheidippides that sells shoes. Also, the marathon, which we're familiar with from running marathons, is 26 miles long, and it's 26 miles long because the distance between Athens and Marathon is about 26 miles. Now, I'm saying these things with some trepidation because our guest, Dave Phil, who is Paul's father, is a fan of history and is acquainted with these facts. So don't hesitate, Gil, to correct me when I'm wrong. The second Persian war occurred when Xerxes, son of Darius I, invaded again the Greek peninsula in 480 BC. And we will remember from the movie 300 that the Spartans and others struggled at Thermopylae, a very narrow place along the coast, what was then the coast, to stop the Persians, and that was one of the great moments of freedom in the Western tradition. That was not a successful battle for the Spartans, and all of the 300 Spartans died, thus the name of the movie, 300. And the Persians came through, but they were defeated in the Battle of Salamis, which was a great naval battle, and finally in the Battle of Plataea in 479. Plataea is in Boeotia, which is northwest of Athens, and that was the end of the Persian invasion. Now think about the pride that the Greeks and Athens in particular would have had over these two great victories over millions. I mean, it was alleged that millions were coming across, or a million were coming across from Persia to invade Greece, and yet the small city-states of Greece defeated them. Anyway, the Greeks were very proud of themselves at this time, and following that war, the Great Persian War, there was an enormous flourishing. And we'll talk about that briefly in a moment. What I want to do now is talk about the end of the great period, because I'm talking about bracketing of Pericles' life. The first part was the Persian Wars, and the ending part was the Peloponnesian Wars. The Peloponnesian Wars were a series of wars between Athens and Sparta, and the first war happened between 460 and 445. And this was a period when Pericles was one of the leaders of Athens, and that was more or less successful, ending in a so-called 30 years peace. But the war renewed in 431 BC, which was very shortly, and very shortly after that, Pericles died. So the final war, the final series of wars, the Peloponnesian War, began in 431, lasted for almost 25 years, and ended in 404 with the Sparta taking over of Athens, and you know this was the end of the Athenian democracy. So these two wars, the Persian War and the Peloponnesian War, are the brackets for the Golden Age of Greece. Now, perhaps you don't need proof that it was a golden age, but I will provide you some. This was the period when Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides, the three great playwrights who many of their works have come down to us, thrived. Aeschylus' dates were 525 to 455, so he died in the middle of the golden age. Sophocles, though, has dates totally coextensive with the period. He was born in 497 and died in 406, so he, you know, started at the beginning with the Persian War and died at the end of the Peloponnesian War. Euripides is the same as true of him. He was born in 480 and died in 406. So these great Greek playwrights were right in the heart of the Golden Age. Another interesting set of dates is Socrates, who I love and who we've studied many times in this group. Socrates was born in 467 and died in 399. So he was born in the middle of the Golden Age and died just after its end. So the greatest of the great people that we know and study were in existence during this period of time. Now, Pericles was an aristocrat. He was born to two great families, and when his mother had a dream the night before he was born that she was going to give birth to a lion, and then in the next day, in 495 BC, she gave birth to Pericles. Now, Plutarch says that he was perfectly formed baby, except that he had a squib head or something like that. And you see the picture of him there with that helmet on. Apparently he is depicted with a helmet on. He's apparently a cone head, essentially. Lots of jokes are made about the shape of his head, but it was it's described as a sea onion, and I don't know what a sea onion looked like, but that's apparently what his head looked like, so he had a little oddness to the shape of his head. He was a very, very rich man, and one of the ways that he influenced people was by giving great deeds, putting on great festivals. It's interesting to me that he was the one who put on The Persians, which is a play by Aeschylus, at the beginning of his political career. And this was common for wealthy people to be the great sponsors for plays, for the theater, for spectacles. And The Persians is a particularly interesting spectacle because it was a relatively benevolent look at the Persian side of the Persian War, which is somewhat, I would think, would have been somewhat controversial to look in a friendly way or an open way or an objective sort of way at the enemy, this great enemy, Persia, who had invaded them twice and not that far in the distant past. So he became of a great power. One of his Athens was the head of the Delian League, which was sort of the empire of the Greek world during this period of time, and Athens was extremely wealthy as a consequence. And Pericles entered into a building program, and many of the great buildings that we all now admire in Greece were the product of the work or the sponsorship of Pericles. You see here a picture of the long walls. The long walls were a great source of irritation to the Spartans. They were walls that completely surrounded the city of Athens, then straight on down to the Piraeus, which is the seaport for Greece, and then they surrounded the Piraeus. And the reason for why these walls were so important was that Athens could withstand a siege on their city because they had access to the sea by virtue of these walls. They could not be surrounded because they had these walls that connected with the ocean, and therefore they could, you know, sail their boats to and from places to get supplies. And these long walls were very, very important. One way to think about the long walls is sort of like a nuclear weapon in these days, right? In our current times, we don't want other people to get nuclear weapons. In these times, Sparta saw these walls as a nuclear weapon. It was a very, very powerful defensive mechanism which could not be overcome, and they did not want Athens to get it, and that particular aspect was one of the reasons for the subsequent wars with Sparta. Also, of course, we're very familiar with the Parthenon, which is depicted there. Parthenon is on top of the Acropolis. I always thought the Acropolis was the name of the building, but it's actually the outcropping, which is that huge rock in the middle of Athens on which a great many of these buildings are constructed. So this is the historical period in which Pericles lived. And now what I'd like to do is read a couple of these episodes out of the book so that we could get some sense of the character of Pericles. Let me just start because we only have 8 minutes before we're going to hear his great speech. Pericles, Plutarch is speaking here. "And so I decided to carry on writing the lies, the parallel lies," Plutarch says, "and have composed this book, the 10th in the series, which includes the lives of Pericles and of Fabius Maximus," which I mentioned to you earlier today and said that we'll look at Fabius Maximus next time, who fought so relentlessly against Hannibal. There are a number of similarities between the two men in respect of their virtues, but the most important traits they shared were self-possession and integrity. And I hope that the episodes that I'm going to read here shortly will illustrate that. "And their ability to endure the foolishness of the populace and their colleagues that made them of particular value to their countries." So this is Plutarch's view of Pericles and the explanation of why he wrote these lies. Then Plutarch cites a little episode which I thought was very illuminating about the character of Pericles. So he never went out much, Pericles, apparently, because he wanted to remain somewhat aloof and maintain his privacy so that people would not become his buddy. You know, a ruler... It's not good to be buddies with the ruler because they don't take your orders very well. So one time he was walking back from the square or the downtown, and he said, "At any rate, on one occasion he had insults and abuse hurled at him," that is Pericles did, "by some crude and outrageous fellow in the city square, where he had pressing business to see to. And he, Pericles, endured it all day long and went home in the evening, perfectly composed, with the man following him and calling him all kinds of names. By the time he, Pericles, got home, it was dark, And just before going inside, he told one of his slaves to take a torch and escort the man back to his house, presumably because the man couldn't find his way without a guide. I mean, what a big man. What a huge soul. One of my favorite things to say about judges is that sometimes a judge is bigger than his office. And he, you know, does, and sometimes he's too small, and so he has to puff himself up to fill the space which his office necessitates. But Pericles was obviously a big-souled man, and was big enough to take these abuses, which were probably just part of the territory, and remain equanimous and kind to the people who are about him. Okay, that's a great indication, I think, of the kind of person he is.
Here's absolutely so different from the Persians. You would not yell anything at Sir.
Absolutely not. Right. Absolutely not. Okay, Thucydides, this is not the historian, describes Pericles' government, or maybe the historian, quasi-aristocratic, when he says that it was nominally democracy, but actually ruled by the leading man. Whereas many others say that at first he seduced the Athenian people with grants of land abroad, money for festivals, and the financial handouts, that they were corrupted into bad habits by his policies at the time, and that they became extravagant and undisciplined instead of self-controlled and self-supporting. We therefore need to refer to his actual deeds to consider the reasons for this change in him. I read this not so much to illustrate his character, but to illustrate that his character is not undisputed. There are some people who did not like Pericles, including Plato, and so there is sort of a historical dispute as to the exact nature of him. Now, here is an episode which describes the buildings that Pericles was responsible for building. For all the wonderful size, inimitable beauty, and exceptional charm of the buildings that then began to rise, and for all the fine workmanship of the craftsmen who were striving to surpass the limits of their craft, the most astonishing thing of all was the speed of progress. I just think about the World Trade Center that's being trying to be replaced in our time, and we just can't quite get it done. And back when they built in the 30s, the Empire State Building, it took a year. They built the Empire State Building in 1 year. That reminds me of the speed with which Pericles built their Pantheon of Parthenon. Whereas people imagined that each of them would take many successive generations at least to be completed, every one of them was finished within the prime of a single administration. There is a story that once when Agathagoras, the painter, was boasting about the speed and ease with which he created the figures, Zeuxis, who heard him, says, it will take a long time over mine. And in fact, it is true that the dexterity and speed do not give a piece of art lasting weight and precisions in conveying beauty, and that time invested in the hard work during the production of a piece pays a dividend in strength manifest in its durability when complete. This is what makes Pericles' works even more impressive, because they have a durability despite having been completed quickly. In terms of beauty, each of them was a classic straight away at the time. But in terms of vigor, each is a new and recent creation even today. And this could be said even today, right? Even this very day. And so a kind of freshness forms a constant bloom on them and keeps their appearance untouched by time, as if they contained an evergreen spirit and an unaging soul mixed together. And this is so true. These monuments are so spectacular. Here's an episode which so is magnificent, I think. This is an episode, and this is, they're worried about the buildings, and Pericles, what he has to say about them. So the politicians who supported Thucydides were loudly denouncing Pericles for having squandered and wasted the tribute money in building these buildings. He, Pericles, therefore got up before the assembly and asked the Athenians people whether they thought that he had spent too much for these great buildings and the long walls. When they said that he had spent too much, he replied, quote, "In that case, it should not be on you to incur the cost, but me." In other words, he says, "I'll pay for it." And then he says, "But I will have only my name inscribed on the sacred buildings." Oops! No way. They backed off. and he didn't have to pay for the buildings. They wanted those buildings. Here's an instance of his financial worries. It may be that in this regard, Pericles' behavior clashed with the wise Anaxagoras, who was so carried away by his high principles that he actually abandoned his estate and left the land uncultivated and fit for only sheep to graze. Anaxagoras was a philosopher. But it seems to me that the life of a philosopher, with his purely intellectual pursuits, is different from that of a politician. The noble use the one puts to his mind involves no tools and requires no external material. In other words, the noble use that a philosopher puts his mind to. Whereas the other, that is the politician, applies his talents to human needs. And so for him, wealth will sometimes prove to be not just a necessity, but something noble, as it was in Pericles' case, since he helped a great many poor people. We only have two more, and then we'll hear our great speech. I like this one. It's talking about how he spent money. While defending his year in office as military commander, Pericles recorded an expenditure of 10 talents for necessities. 10 talents is a lot. One talent can buy a warship. People accepted this without taking it any further and without investigating what was leaving unsaid. In other words, what are these necessities? Some writers, including the philosopher Theognostus, had reported that every year 10 talents found their way to Sparta from Pericles, and that he used this money to appease everyone in positions of authority and so to avoid war. The object, they say, was not to buy peace, but time, in which he could make his preparations at his own pace and so wage more and more efficiently. Now, isn't that a beautiful expenditure of money? You bribe the enemy not to attack you? I mean, it sounds wicked in a way, but think about the savings in property, in lives. You know, I'm not a big fan of foreign aid, which America spends a lot on, but when you think about it in that context, is foreign aid more important than war? It's a very interesting subject. All right, let's see here. This is the last one, and it's a prelude, I think, to our speech. This is the last one. On his return to Athens after the conquest of Samos, Pericles gave those who had died in the fighting a distinguished burial and delivered the customary speech over their tombs, which we will hear almost instantly. The speech was widely admired, but he was descending from the rostrum and accepting the greetings of all the other women who were crowning him with garlands and chaplets as if he were a victorious athlete. Elpinisi came up to him and said, quote, "What a wonderful job you've done, Pericles. How well you deserve these garlands. After all, you have caused the death of a large number of brave Athenians, and done so in a war not fought against the Phoenicians or the Persians, which was the kind of war my brother Simon waged, but in subduing an allied city, a city of fellow Greeks," close quote. In other words, she's criticizing him for having engaged in a civil war and killed Athenians. Pericles, the story goes, quietly smiled at her at these words of Elpicini, and he said to her this, quote, "An old woman like you should not anoint herself with perfume," close quote. What a cad. Okay, so let's hear this funeral oration that resulted in that comment.
So it says that